To the very first episode of The Unwind, which is a new series talking about all things tech and video game related. I am Rob Steller.
And I'm Sean Thomas.
And we are part of a larger project we're starting called the Commentist Block, which is a collective group of people talking about all the things that we are most passionate about. And this includes everything from tech to video games to sports to politics and culture. And we'll be launching our site within the next couple of weeks, so be sure to look out for that, and I will make sure to post something in the comments below.
So, for our inaugural episode, we thought we would cover a game called Bioshock Infinite, which, if you haven't heard of it, you need to go outside and go get it, because it's incredible, and it's pretty much been in the news a lot lately, so... we also want to mention, before we start this thing, that this is going to be full of spoilers.
Absolutely full. Nothing is off the table. We can talk about anything we want. So if you haven't seen the game, or haven't played the game, definitely make sure you play it before you watch this, or unless you're not intending to play this at all. Because we will definitely talk about the ending.
So please, if you've not played it, just go out and play it. That's the best thing to do right now. Go do it. So... before we begin, just a basic thing, a primer on Bioshock. It's basically a game set in 1900s America, and basically most of the game is set in a city called Columbia. It's a fictional city, and it's led by a mysterious religious figure named Father Comstock. And it delves into a lot of mature themes, including racism, religiosity, and a lot of deeper themes like time travel and multiple universes and things like that. And when the game first came out, there were just tons of reviews that came out, and they were pretty much universally positive, all talking about how great the ending was, how incredible, and how mind-blowing it was. So, Rob, like, what did you feel when you first played the game after hearing about how good it was?
Yeah, I have to say, I've never gone into playing a game having higher expectations than I did for Bioshock Infinite. I mean, I did my very best to avoid reading anything about the storyline. I didn't look at any of the reviews. Of course, I saw the scores, which were all 9s, 9.5s, mostly 10s. I mean, everyone was saying this is nearly a perfect game or a perfect game, so it's a lot to go into and a lot of pressure playing it because you are expecting the best from it. And I have to say... about halfway through, I was getting a little worried that it wasn't going to live up to these expectations, but by the time I finished it and the credits started rolling, I could say my mind was officially blown, and I can't say that everything was a surprise to me by the end, but I mean, as you start putting things together, it definitely leads to probably the best ending of a game I've ever played.
See, that's funny, because you went about it in the exact opposite way of me, in that... well, okay, I shouldn't say the exact opposite way, but basically you didn't want to hear anything about it, and I totally understand that. But for me, I had to read the reviews. I just want to know about it. Does it really live up to its hype? And actually, it sounds funny. As much as I love Bioshock 1, for some reason I didn't have this real inclination where I'm like, I really want to play this game. I actually wasn't a huge fan of Columbia. The Rapture was just such a powerful world, and it was so dark, which was, you know, it's what made it, you know? So when I actually saw Columbia, I was kind of like, okay, this is all right. But I heard how great the ending was and so much hype, and to me, it totally fulfilled the hype. And I think we both were on the same wavelength where at the end of the game, we weren't totally sure what happened. We knew a lot of the stuff happened. We knew transformation. We knew Booker and Comstock were the same person. We understand there are multiple universes. You know,
you mentioned there's spoilers in this.
But, you know, there's the man, the lighthouse, and the third thing. And, but, you know, I didn't put it all together. And, you know, actually, this is one of the most beautiful things about it. As I read more about it, it becomes more and more poignant and more powerful, which is something that, you know, I hate to say never, but I can't remember the last game that's really done it for me. Maybe, as we talked about previously, Mass Effect 3 with the whole indoctrination theory angle. But
right, which we won't go into just in case you haven't played that. But the big difference is, though, is that indoctrination theory was most likely not the intentional outcome for those writers, whereas Ken Levine and his staff clearly were going for this ending. This was what was intended all along. I mean, it was absolutely genius. And I will say, it's definitely the first game that I felt absolutely compelled the minute after I finished to pick up and play through it all again. And I have started doing that. I'm midway or so through the second playthrough, and you really can't appreciate how genius this game is until you start playing it through a second time, and you actually realize, like, little bits of dialogue, all the songs that you heard, and little signs and things you see along the way all have wildly significant meanings after you already know what's about to happen.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing I want to definitely say, I don't know how you felt, like, the game wasn't absolutely perfect. It's really the narrative they struck. They right. did such a good job on, and it's something that, I don't know, I've never seen before, and the level of detail and the narrative, the story they wove through the whole game, it was just something unlike anything other. I mean, but really, I'll say for this, most of the podcast, we're probably going to be focusing more on the story right. rather than the gameplay elements, but those are important, so we might get to that as well.
Do you want to start with the gameplay elements and get that out of the way?
Sure, okay, if you want. So you shoot things, a couple things you shoot. A lot of things people had seen, like, I kind of agreed, there were a lot of times when I felt like, man, I just kept shooting everything. It was just nothing but shooting, and I really wanted to learn more about the story. Mm. So that was definitely a detractor for me. I mean, I kind of wanted to have the story fleshed out. Well, I wanted to learn more about the story as we were going. Well,
yeah, I think it's the first game, kind of talking what you're saying. I mean, it's the first game I played where the action of it was kind of secondary to what the story was. And honestly, for me, all the scenes where you're shooting things was just a means of a way to getting to the next piece of storyline or finding out that next bit of information.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, it's funny, I mean, I don't want to go too far off topic, but when you look at this game, I mean, the first thing, it's powerful enough that you start thinking, hey, this is probably one of the best games of this generation, you know, of the whatever Xbox 360, PS3 era, or whatever, and then you start thinking of a larger level, and it's funny because I feel like a lot of the best games, the things that are considered the best of all time, always end up being focused a little more on the gameplay elements, like, you know, say, I don't know, Resident Evil 4. To me, it was a really fun game, but I don't know, I felt like it's a Resident Evil game. The narrative never gets too high. The voice acting wasn't great. You know, you think of games like that, even Super Mario, you know, it's really whimsical world, and it's beautifully painted and things like that, but it's not, it doesn't make you think. So this is the first game that really decided, we want to tell a story very tightly, and we really want to get something out here.
One thing I will say about the game mechanics in general that I think they did better than any other game I played is introducing all of the moves, like the controls for the game. Mm-hmm. And the way they did that, so, is instead of saying, oh, you know, you press A to jump, you hit right trigger to shoot. So the way they do it is, you know, you do those carnival games in the beginning where you're shooting the Vox Populi that kind of like pop out of the side. Watch them with a shotgun. Why not?
No.
So I will say I think that was one of the most interesting ways of showing gameplay. That being said, there were some really odd, like, clearly gameplay mechanics that took away a little bit. Like, when you're going through I forget the name of the district with all the poor people, where Fink's, not after Fink, right? Where you're going through all where the poor people are.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you know, there's signs about how we're hungry and everything. There's, like, an apple on the side. Where you'll find coins, like, underneath sleeping poor people that you're like, oh, thank you very much.
It's incredible how many weapons they hide in barrels all around the city. I mean, you pick up stuff everywhere.
People just throw away money, man. Just people in Columbia just don't care. Like, oh, well, here you go. There's hot dogs everywhere.
Yeah, some of them are rotten. And, you know, but you know what? This speaks to a larger thing of video games where it's really hard for video games to be, and I don't think this is what people want it to be, but it's really hard for video games to not be games to some extent. They have to have the game mechanic part. Like, as realistic as the story is, I mean, you're still, at the end of the day, you have a shield, and you pick up health things, you know, that restore your health bar. I mean, there still is video game elements. Even as you can only use two weapons at once, I mean, you can carry a rocket launcher on your back and some other giant gun. So it's unrealistic in that way, but it's a game. That's one thing it's very difficult to, you know, bridge that gap.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely a conversation that we could have on its own show or on its own, own podcast. So, all right, coming back to the storyline a little bit, I will say, like you were saying before, it was probably the best storyline of any game that I've ever played. I've definitely never.
Which is not an easy thing to say. It's not like one of those you just throw that out there. But
no, I think we were making that list of over what 300 games that I think we've played, and I don't think anything's come close to how good this was or how well written this was. And it's definitely pushing the bar for narratives. I think as far as games to come, especially in the next generation with these the new Xbox and the new PlayStation coming out in. I don't know, what, 6-7 months, right? So we don't have that gap of graphic, that threshold that we're crossing, you know, going from Xbox to Xbox 360 where you have HD all of a sudden. So, you know, we're not jumping to 4K or anything like that. So I think where games need to go now to impress people is around storyline.
I hope. And gameplay. I mean, yeah. I think it's something people have been pushing for years. I don't think anyone started a game thinking, hey, we don't care about the story at all. I think the difference is now...
I played some games that had pretty shitty story.
Okay, fine. But you know what I mean. I think there are people who tried to make a good story. I mean, it's not for lack of trying, I'll put it that way. But the thing is, there's really just... Especially when you compare the quality of television shows that are out now, and like in the past decade, you have Mad Men, The Sopranos, The Wire, Breaking Bad... Walking Dead to some extent, and
Firefly.
But like you have all those, and it's like you just go back to games, and there's always this feeling of, hey, this is a good story for a video game,
right?
And this is the first one where I've played where I'm like, hey, this could actually hang with the big boys of, you know, I don't know, traditional entertainment like movies and television.
So, what do you think about the storyline made it so much better than all the other games? What set it apart for you?
Well, there are a couple things. First of all, Elizabeth, the way she was, the way she acted, like the lines they gave her and voice actress and things like that, she pulled you in immediately. Most games, you build a relationship with the characters, but it's more because you spend hours and hours and hours with the character. And it's not like there's horrible writing. I mean, they obviously want you to connect, but part of it is because you spent so long with a character and you've played as a character, that's why you become such a strong connection. But Bioshock, I mean, they don't have that much time, maybe 10, 12 hours, and they still make you care so much about Elizabeth. We'll get to that more later, but there's Elizabeth. There is the idea of time travel and how they wove it in multiple ways. Like, it's not like no one's done time travel before. It's not like no one's done multiverse. Even it's not even like no one's done. We're gonna change the bad guy and find out he's the same thing as the good guy, kind of thing. Right. But the way they put it all together, their attention to detail, and it just all came together in a nice package that made a lot of sense. Made you think. It never gave you too much, but it always you're always on the edge of feeling like you knew what was going on, but you never really did.
And even at the end, I mean, you're still there and you're like, oh, well, I get that Booker and Comstock were the same person, but I have no idea how that works.
Yeah.
And I was telling you, it's one of the first – actually, it is the first game where as soon as the last Elizabeth disappeared or not, I guess, depending on what theory you go by. But when that last when the credits started rolling and that flash of light came on, I sat there for a few minutes and I was just like, I don't know what to think of this. I think this is clearly awesome, but I clearly don't get all of it right now.
Yeah.
But it was the first game where I was like, okay, I need to go read up on everything I can find. And actually the entire weekend after I played it, that's all I did was look up forums and message boards. I wanted to see different people's theories on different things. And it was the first game that I actively researched after playing it. And like I said, it was the first game that I've really wanted to pick up and play again. And like I said earlier, it was you really can't appreciate how much detail that they paid attention to until you play it a second time through.
Yeah, I mean, and this is actually one thing that differentiated it from the first one. When the first one came out, Bioshock 1, everybody had this similar feelings about the story. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, One of the most memorable lines in gaming history, I think, is going to be, would you kindly? Like, it just, it's cemented there. It's just very powerful. But a Bioshock that pretty much universally agreed on, what it failed on was its final third. After you met Andrew Ryan and you find out that whole thing and, you know, you find out what would you kindly mean, it kind of went downhill. And then, you know, it literally, the ending was a boss battle. It's exactly what you think it's going to be. It's a video game boss battle. They were smarter about Infinite. They decided, hey, we're going to actually have a denouement. Like, they're going to bring it down at some level. They're going to add exposition at the right points. They're not going to make it feel like the last third is just awful. And that's a testament to the writing. They learned from it, and they got better at it. So.
Right, and it had a lot to do with character development, too, and how much emotions, how much you cared about Elizabeth from the beginning. Also, one of the interesting things is you didn't have to protect her, which I thought was a phenomenal choice on their part, because in Bioshock 2, when you're running around as a big daddy and you have to protect the little sisters, I mean, it's a pain in the ass to just sit there and all these spices running on you, and you're just like, just take care of yourself. I don't really care that much about you. But in this, I think it was a great choice that they didn't make you protect Elizabeth. And also, you know, all the emotion that she portrayed through her voice, the transition she went from pretty being really naive and, you know, coming out of the tower from the beginning and then kind of developing, you know, you start to see her kind of more sexually with her change of clothes, and as she starts figuring things out on her own, and then she clearly figures everything out way before you do, and she kind of walks you through those last few steps towards the end there. But I will say there was the one scene where you're listening to Elizabeth being tortured, I think brought out the most emotion in me, probably than any other scene that I can remember, except for one from Mass Effect 3, which I won't bring up. But I think that's where games need to go now, is figuring out how to bring this powerful emotion out of their players, right?
Yeah, it was crazy. When you hear you're getting tortured, you really want to jump in there and be like, no, I'm going to save you, even though you know you can't, and you see it, you slowly...
even though you're running around trying to find all the guns in the
So that's another side thing, like, this goes into the video game. So you were talking about how the great thing about Elizabeth is that you don't have to take care of her, which I think is great. I hate, you know, you have games like you had mentioned in Bioshock 2, which I actually didn't play, but you have the little sister, you got to protect her all day. You know, in Resident Evil 4, you have to protect, I think, Ashley. Well, whatever. You have all these games where you have these protection parts, which just, they just don't feel right. And I like the fact that they took the pressure off her. And I like the gameplay mechanics, although the story-wise, it seemed ridiculous. But this is one of those things I'm willing to put to the side because I don't think it really hurts the game. Like, for example, you know, if you have the power to open tears, it seems kind of weird that she's pulling out freight hooks from the ceiling. And, you know, like, the cover kind of makes sense, but the freight hooks thing seems weird.
Here's an automated turret.
Yeah, exactly. She's like, I have a rocket launcher. I'm just going to pull it out. And she's always throwing you salts and stuff like that and health. But one thing they showed in the first trailer, the 2010 trailer, that was really cool. I don't know why they cut it out. Maybe it was too difficult to do. But her tears, she's essentially pulling something from the environment that could be useful. Like, the first one they show is you've got all these enemies, like 10 enemies coming at you, and you're shooting the shock jockey, electricity at them. And it's kind of futile, because every time you shock one, there's another one coming at you. What she does is she opens up a tear, and rain clouds come in. And then you shock the rain clouds, and it kills all of them at once. It's like, you know, interacting with the environment. Something a little more unique. It's going in. It makes sense. Something that would work. So I really like that. I don't know why they trashed that idea. But either way...
Sorry, this brings up another interesting thing on how you actually play the game. So I know when you said... You were telling me about this. I mean, you pretty much stuck to a couple guns and a couple vigors the entire time, right?
Yeah. And I should mention, I played it on hard, and that kind of changes the way you play things, because I feel like you have to, you know, you find the things you like and you have to stick with them because you have to upgrade them and you have to do... I mean, it wasn't a ridiculously hard game or anything like that, but it was hard enough that you had to think about it.
Yeah, but there was... I think the video that you're referring to where she brings in the cloud and then you shock it, there was... I felt like they didn't let you experiment enough combining different vigors together, and maybe this just was the way that I played it, but I tended to use Undertow to push guys back whenever they got too close, and then use the Crows to distract them, and then just ran around with the assault rifle. Or I just stayed back and I picked them off with the sniper rifle.
Yeah, that sniper rifle is definitely different and normal. And actually, yeah, my second playthrough, I'm definitely going to do this, or play it on normal. But one thing I was going to say, yeah, I didn't even realize there were combos. I didn't know you could use two vigors together and they would make something more powerful. I mean, I kind of saw that sometimes, but I didn't know they actually had real combos until I read about it online. I was like, oh, why didn't I do that? But one interesting thing about that, so I've heard a number of reviewers say one of the negative points of the game was that a lot of the vigors seem underpowered and you stick to these two. But the funny thing is, every person I heard talking about how they stuck to those two, they all stuck to a different two. Like, for example, I think the first review I saw of it, they stuck with the Return to Sender and one other one. I never used Return to Sender after I first got it. I stuck with Shock
Trap. Once I got it, that's pretty much the only thing that I use.
Exactly. And if you watch the Polygon Roundtable, I think Chris Plant said he used this combination of Charge, two of the gears and something else to constantly kill people. And Arthur Geese, or guys who is another guy there, he used Murder of Crows or whatever the entire game. And so it's kind of funny that people talk about how there isn't enough variety, but it seems like there was all the variety. You just ended up sticking to one.
Right, and I think it put a lot of the choice into the player to see how they want to play through the game, which is another cool aspect of this. The other thing I wanted to talk about is just how crazy the environment itself was. Mm-hmm. There are other games, like I will say I spent a decent amount of time running through Elder Scrolls Skyrim, and I mean,
whole life.
Yeah, fair enough. It was a lot. But the interesting, so Skyrim, I think they probably have, well, they have an open world, so they have a little bit different platform, but they had like all the books that you could read that had to do with the history. And I mean, there was a lot of detail that, probably more detail that went into that environment than BioShock. But I was way more compelled and wanted to learn more about the BioShock world than the Skyrim world. And I think a lot of that had to do with how much they pulled you in right from the beginning. So when you go up and you're in Columbia, you know, it seems like this happy place and everybody's very, you know, celebrating this, whatever it was called, their Independence Day or whatever. And everyone's very white and happy with being white. And but just as soon as you have that choice, well, I guess it's not really a choice because it doesn't matter the outcome, but as soon as they bring out the interracial couple where, you know, they find out that you're the false prophet, everything kind of is a whirlwind from there. But leading up to it, I spent so much time just walking around, like looking at different buildings and just looking around Columbia and out in the clouds and different buildings.
And one thing that, sorry, I cut you off, Kibo.
No, go ahead.
One thing that totally separated Infinite from BioShock 1. So BioShock, you could tell at the beginning of both games they wanted to almost shock you with the world. And in Rapture, it's that moment you go over that rock in the bathysphere and you see the world. And this one, it's when you pop out of the clouds and you see the world. But one huge difference is Rapture is already destroyed. It's already, whatever, post-apocalyptic, if you want to say.
Right.
Everything's already gone to crap, and you have the splicers. Completely different in Infinite. In Infinite, everybody's happy. It's such
Although, funny enough, just to cut in real quick, one of the original makes of the game, I read that there were... One of the interesting things is nobody else really uses vigors. I mean, you have those fire guys.
Yeah.
The crow guy, but nobody really uses these vigors, but they're sold everywhere, and everybody has access to them.
Yeah.
But in one of the original makes of the game, or previous versions of the game, they had people who were like splicers who essentially overdosed on these vigors, but they decided to take those out.
Yeah, if you see, I want to say, the 2011 E3 video, the one guy you meet, and actually they totally cut this guy out of the game, is like Simon Stahl or something like that, whatever. They cut him out, but in the beginning of the game, you immediately see some guy using a vigor. He used Murder of Crows. Mm-hmm. In the beginning. And it's, so I've been trying to figure this out. in that the whole fact that they have Vigors in the world, clearly they advertise it, they say it's all there, but nobody seems to use it, which is weird. I mean, they do have those. I don't know.
They actually they have people talking about it. So this second time playing through, I'm literally going up to every single person I meet on the streets and listening to what they have to say.
A couple of them reference.
They're like, oh yeah, I've tried them. Like, they're cool, whatever.
But, I can shoot fireballs, but now I don't.
There's those two guys in the carnival that you originally go into with all the games where you're learning the shooting mechanics. There are those two guys with the masks that are using the Vigors to demonstrate it.
Oh yeah. I mean,
it's not like you fight them or anything. So.
Yeah, but they're there. Yeah, and it almost sounds like they were doing that just to show people do use Vigors.
Yeah.
What I was trying to get at though, in Bioshock 1, you had all the splices, so you knew this is what happened to them, but how many of them actually used powers?
That's a good question.
Because that's what I was trying to figure out. Like, so the difference is this, with the splicers, it was obvious that they had been ruined by it. So you know the effects were there. In Infinite, you don't see the effects of it, except for there's the firebombing guy, there's, you know, the Murder of Crows guy, General Slade can shoot lightning, the shock jockey one. They have bits of that, so they do put it in. But I was thinking, like, in Bioshock 1, I don't think you fight any enemies.
I think there's a couple people that do. But
either
again,
way, it's not common. But it makes sense because you know that's how the splicers became the splicers. Like, it fits into the world. But that goes into, I know you wanted to talk about the whole connection between Bioshock 1, Rapture, and... Rapture and Columbia.
One of the things that wasn't immediately apparent to me that I found out through reading everything else. Well, you hear a little bit about in the Voxophones, especially with the Lutesses and with Fink, where that's how they have all these songs that you've heard of, and there's different covers of them, which are absolutely brilliant. I mean, we could go on about how good the soundtrack was.
It was very little. Like, they didn't overdo it. I mean, there were a couple of times you felt somewhat, but you always had this feeling of, you know what it is, but you can't quite place it because they do it in the vaudeville fashion rather than the traditional way it's done.
Right. I mean, it's very subtle. So it's like, oh, I recognize that song, but it's not the song itself that you're hearing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we can go on about how good the music is. And I lost my train of thought now. That's what you get for interrupting me.
Well, you were talking about how the connection between Rapture and...
Right. Okay. So they make a lot of references as far as that's where the Vigors came from, is that they saw the plasmids from Rapture. Well, they don't call out Rapture specifically, but they say they saw it through a tear. Fink's brother was said that he saw, or he heard the music through tears, and he just rewrote it obviously before it came out. The other big thing too was Songbird, which we haven't talked about yet, and there was one Voxophone in particular that mentions seeing the melding of man and machine, which you're led to believe are big daddies, although I guess it doesn't necessarily have to be. But and the one of the comments I read on one forum, they believed that Songbird was actually Booker that Comstock had taken from one of the other parallel universes to make a Songbird, since he already had that connection to his daughter. He obviously wanted to protect her, and that's why he's so vigilant in protecting her whenever you know he senses danger.
That's cool. I mean, I think that's interesting. I definitely did not think of that. I felt like Songbird could be that, in that Songbird clearly has his affection for Elizabeth, so I could see the whole Booker somewhat being Songbird, but I never made that leap. Because it just seemed too disconnected. I never thought, hey, maybe you came back. But, you know, I mean, I guess it could make sense. I mean, he did find this Booker, so why couldn't he find another Booker at some other point and turn him into Songbird, I guess?
Yeah. So the other thing about Songbird's obviously a very central character that you don't really get any information about, other than, you know, he's trying to kill you the entire time, and you're like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to blow this thing up somehow later in the game, and then that never comes. And then you actually end up using him against the Vox Populi at that point, right? So,
this is the way they made you look at Songbird. I mean, clearly it's just a giant, you know, machine bird. That's what it is. Like, there's no other way to put it. Yeah. And it's, but they were totally able to convey the thing that it has. It's incredibly defensive of Elizabeth, and it cares so much about Elizabeth, and you know that's what its purpose is. But to convey that emotion is very difficult, and then to have this change of heart. I mean, you know, the whole game, you're like, okay, I'm gonna play Songbird at the end. Like, that's gonna be the final boss, and you're thinking, man, I'm going to lose 100 times, and I'm going to be so annoyed. But they don't, and you don't play them. And the ending, it's really so much better. It'd be so. I mean. The way Songbird's arc, I mean, they don't really use him or her that much, but the way it's used is really efficient and really well done.
Would you have rather fought Songbird as like a big boss?
No, not at all. I think that, I don't know, I can't envision a situation in which they use Songbird in that way where you fight him, and it works in the story. The way he died or she died, to me, like, you literally go from most of the game where you kind of hate Songbird. I mean, you know, you feel like he's going to kill you.
Every time you get in the blimp, he just takes you down and start all over again.
Screw you, I'm going to
The game could have been like 10 minutes long. You could have got up in the blimp. Oh, we're in Paris. That's the end of the game.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I got to keep the game going. But, I mean, I know I'm getting ahead of myself a bit, but when you see him, so at the end, when you flip into Rapture, you see him dying, and you kind of care, and you kind of feel bad. I mean, I definitely felt bad. Like, it's this sad dying of a pet, and you see Elizabeth kind of
telling him to let it go, right?
Yeah, and calming him down, like you're putting a dog to sleep, and it's just so powerful.
So, did you notice in the background of that scene, you can see out into Rapture, and you see a Big Daddy and a little sister, and the little sister looks like she's comforting the dead.
Yeah,
Big, which is kind
I didn't see that at all. I found that out later. I totally didn't notice that.
Which is kind of an interesting time to put that in, right? Because, I mean, essentially the exact same thing. And also, there's other pictures that show that Elizabeth's, the clothes that she wears, the blue and white, are pretty much the exact same as the little sister's, or very...
Oh, okay, yeah.
So let's go back to that scene in Rapture. It's funny because I actually had a completely different different time. As soon as we were set to Rapture, I was like, oh my god, this is awesome. They were playing Django Reinhardt's Lemaire, which is one of the big songs from Bioshock 1 and something I still listen to now. And I was so excited to be back in Rapture. I was so afraid because she kind of just like took you there out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, we're only going to be here for like 3 seconds. I want to see everything in Rapture before we go. I was like, I was so nostalgic and I just wanted to see Rapture again.
Okay.
As soon as we got in there, I started sprinting around. I was like, oh my god, what's here? What's here? What can I find? And I caught only some of the somber thing. Like, you can hear the dialogue, but I was like, nah, fuck that shit. That's going to happen. And I'm going to go do my thing over here and I want to see what's going on. Well, I guess, Sean, you still there? Oh, okay.
Sorry about that. So, yeah, sorry for that. Connection issues. Great way to start the podcast. But, before we do that, I just want to set up like the ending. So you have the final fight, which I thought actually was a great fight. Instead of doing the we're going to fight Songbird, they essentially have waves of enemies and you have to use multiple things. You pretty much have to use a lot of your powers. You have to use everything at your disposal. So they did a great job with that. But like I said, I kind of want to focus more on the story. So you finish that, you go to the bow of the boat, or the airship, and all of a sudden you tell Songbird, destroy the siphon. And the siphon's the thing that's kind of attenuating Elizabeth's power. So the moment the siphon gets destroyed, all of a sudden you see Elizabeth.
Wow, we lost Sean again. We apologize for the connection issues, but Sean is in New York and apparently they have really bad internet in New York. But anyway, so you're taking through the last battle. It's not what you were expecting it, and you didn't really know that was the end, but like Sean was saying, you fight these waves of enemies. You have to use everything at your disposal, kind of everything that you've learned up until this point. And There he is. He's back. All right. So I was just saying. So I was just reiterating the whole the last scene, right? So you send Songbird to take out the siphon. He destroys it. And do you want to pick up? I'll let you finish.
Sure. Yeah. So no, he destroys it, and then in that moment, you see Elizabeth, and you immediately recognize that she's changed fundamentally. And this is another one of those things that these nuanced moments where they understand how to convey the exact emotion and what you need to understand, that she is kind of like a demigod at that point. You see her eyes change, like she all of a sudden you realize she understands more than you think. And then the key moment is Songbird starts flying at you, and you drop the whistle that, you know, kind of prevents him from attacking you. And then you have this oh crap moment, he's gonna kill me. And then she essentially said, well, I forgot the exact line, he goes, he's coming for us or something like that. And she's like, no, he isn't.
No, he isn't. But it's just this like really calm, like matter-of-fact way where you can tell, like, oh, wait, she knows what she's talking about now.
Exactly. And when she essentially, she opens the tear and you're in rapture. And there's that second where you're in rapture, like, wait a minute, am I here or am I not here? I don't know. And then you turn around and you're like, oh, shit, this is definitely rapture.
Yeah.
And that crazy, the thing that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And I saw the... What is it? Giant Bomb did a video where they, so one of their writers hadn't finished the game. All maybe like six of the other guys had already finished the game, so they did a live video of the other guy finishing the game. And it's interesting to see the way he plays it. So he plays it, they get into Rapture, the first thing he does, he turns around and he's like, oh my gosh, this is Rapture. He starts exploring.
That's exactly what I did.
See, and then you totally miss
the
epilogue, essentially, of Songbird.
You hear it, though. You still hear it. And I turned around and I saw him sinking. Like, I got the gist of it. Songbird dies. It's just like, whatever, okay, that's fine. We move on.
Great.
I got it.
I see how it is. You just move on.
Well, I was so excited to be back in Rapture. This is probably the best environment of a game I'd played up until now.
Yeah, and so that happens, and you realize, okay, something's different. That, and you know, it's so funny because it's easy to do that when they already knew everybody loved Rapture. Everybody knew they loved the world, and they totally could have thrown that in. But the way they threw it in was so well done. They put it as part of the story, and it fit. It didn't feel like, hey, we're just going to do a throwback to nostalgia just for the heck of it. And,
so let me ask you this. So this is where I think we differ a little bit. And that Rapture is in a parallel universe, right? That's not in yours. That's what you're led to believe. Because so you brought through a tear, right? So one of the things I read is when Rapture was created, and in order to use the bathysphere, you had to have the same genetic code as Andrew Ryan, which is why your character, since you're the illegitimate son of him, you were able to use the bathyspheres to begin with, because you have the same DNA, or partly the same DNA. And you actually use the bathysphere in Infinite as well. So what I believe, and what I've read other people, is that that Andrew Ryan was another possible path that you could have taken at some point, another split off of your life, right? So it may not have happened at the baptism, but it may have happened at a different time.
Do
you remember like Andrew Ryan's backstory from Bioshock 1? Actually, I guess that doesn't make sense, right? Because he was from Russia and...
I guess doesn't really fit that. And the other thing is even timeline, because Booker's already in his, 20s, 30s, whatever, in the turn of the century.
That's true.
And,
We debunked a myth live on our show here, so that's good.
That's one. either way, they don't explain it that well, but I don't think it needs to be. I don't think they need to tell you this. This is another key thing that good stories know how to do. They don't tell you everything you have to think about certain things. And actually, this is a little more of a sci-fi thing than just a general narrative thing, that they'll tell you to keep some things mysterious, but they don't want to just give it all away or just give you an explanation, because it's never as satisfying as what you create in your mind. But yeah, there are a lot of different ideas. I had also heard an idea that... this wasn't the Rapture you played in Bioshock 1. It was just another possible universe. And in this universe, the bathyspheres didn't require the DNA.
Well, that's the other thing about this, right, is you can pretty much explain away anything you can't think of an explanation for just by saying, oh, it's just an another parallel universe of the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly, because everything always happens.
There's one other related to Rapture. There's one in that scene with Songbird dying. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up, and there was this video that we were talking about where during, what's the guy's name, the guy who plays the piano in Bioshock 1?
Kyle Fredericks, I think.
Right, so, and the artist comes down, and he's like, no, you're playing wrong, and then he blows him up, right? But supposedly, when he's playing...
Wait, if you haven't seen this video, I think it's a little more confusing, so maybe you should set it up, because I found this video just randomly, and I don't know if this is like a huge theory.
Oh, go ahead. Do you want to say it then?
Well, just basically, in Bioshock 1, there's the part where you see Sandro Cohen, the crazy theater director, whatever you want to say, and there's one guy he has, and he has him playing a piano. And then Sandro Cohen says, you know, you're playing it wrong, so on and so forth. And then since he's playing it wrong, he blows up the piano. But what happens is, while the guy, I think his name's Kyle Fredericks, is playing the piano, faintly in the background, very faintly, but you can hear it, it's the same sound effect used for Songbird.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of speculation of what does that mean, and then so you can keep going.
So the way I took it, and I don't necessarily believe in this, but the way I took it was that the moment that you hear him screaming in Bioshock 1 is the same moment that he dies in Infinite, that you just happen to cross paths and be in the same world at the same time. Do you believe in that? Like, what do you think?
I really don't know. I mean, so the way the theory had been introduced to me, because I obviously didn't catch this. This is another one of those things. You realize how crazy, how interested people are that they find this. Like, this is such a small moment. I have no idea how anyone found this. But
someone must have played through Bioshock 1 again after playing Infinite.
But, you know, like, how do you hear that sound? I had to turn it so far up just to hear what they did. Whatever. So basically, the way the theory had been presented to me was that the idea was that Kyle Fredericks, or the guy who was playing the piano, was Songbird. That this part, I don't know, was reflecting of
makes
that.
No, he was blown up. You see,
I agree. I don't know how it makes any sense, but that's the way the theory was introduced to me. I mean, either way, I don't think there's any concrete evidence to really.
I think he just happened to recycle the sound effect that they used, or it just sounded similar, or something like that.
Yeah, and one thing with that, if you notice, if you watch the 2010 trailer, so one thing, Bioshock Infinite has definitely gone through multiple iterations, and if you watch the 2010 trailer, you can clearly tell that the sound effects used for Songbird are completely different than the ones currently used. Like right now, it sounds more like kind of like a dolphin. It has its own unique vibe. In the 2010 version, it's much more of a traditional monster. It has a loud roar, and it's clearly different than what's in Bioshock 1. So that kind of pushes that theory away. I don't know. The whole theory is kind of crazy.
But it goes to show how dedicated people are and how interested people are about the story, is that they're really looking at everything from the series to see what they can make connections to. I find it a little far-fetched that they were thinking that far into the future, or that they had even written Infinite at that time. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think Kevin Levine knew he was going to write another Bioshock. And I mean, this is not... It might have been because of publisher rights, but, I mean, they made Bioshock 2. If you're a writer and you want to make a second thing in a series, I don't think he would have ever made Bioshock 2. So maybe he didn't think he wanted to revisit Bioshock, the series, and then Bioshock 2 came out just because the publisher had rights, and I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough to say. All right, let's move on to the ending, right? So do you want to...
So, okay, they have Rapture. We talked about Rapture.
So you go through the bathysphere, you come back up to the lighthouses, right?
Yeah, oh, gosh, to the lighthouses.
You walk through the lighthouse, and that's where she goes through the whole thing. Like, there's always a man, there's always a lighthouse. You walk through the door, you see all the other lighthouses, which is one of the many times I actually just stopped and looked around at everything and stayed there a little bit to actually take everything in.
Yeah, and, man, the way... Their decision to use all these lighthouses and all the stars to represent all the possible universes worked really well. Like,
especially because that's what you go down in Bioshock 1, too.
Yeah, that connection, exactly. And I actually immediately, when I started the game, I kind of saw that there was some connection. when you start out in a lighthouse. It's like, okay, this is weird. It's starting kind of the same way as Bioshock 1, where you start in the water and then you go into a lighthouse.
You go
But I
up.
had no idea how they were doing
Yep.
it. And yeah.
So keep going.
Well,
Sorry, I had to
okay.
interrupt.
So, you see, so she explains how there's multiple universes, and each universe is essentially, I guess, a different pathway of things that could have happened. So essentially, when earlier, when Elizabeth shows you New York in 1980, that's one path that could have happened.
That was another crazy scene that we didn't even touch, but I mean,
Yeah, it was
going out and
insane.
seeing old Elizabeth and going back and playing it again, Comstock originally always talks about how what does he say, like the Sodom below is bathed in fire or something like that, but
You will bathe in fire the mountains of man. I
yeah,
actually
there you
didn't
go.
completely get that until I, because they don't put commas, and so I'm like, I didn't know which part of the sentence went
But
with what,
that's in a lot of
and so,
the stone statues you see
yep.
in the beginning. Comstock, I think, references it in one of the Voxaphones outright, and to actually see what he was talking about then, it was just like, oh my God, that's crazy.
It's a funny thing related to that. I know we're not being coherent, but so this whole thing
I
is
don't think it's
so
possible to talk about this
it
game
really
and make it in one straight line.
But it's so funny. The more I talk about it, the more I'm like, man, this was awesome. But anyway, so Father Comstock, he doesn't actually destroy America. So part of the story, I mean, you find out that that Colombia is essentially part of America at the beginning, but at some point when they start attacking China, I believe, that's a part where all of a sudden America says, we want to sever ties with you. You guys are going a little bit off in the deep end. And that's when Colombia has this more of fundamentalist vibe to it, where it says America is a Sodom. They've all broken away from it. This is the perfect America. And the thing I don't get is Father Comstock never destroys New York. He has to have Elizabeth destroy New York. Why
Right, but
can't he do it?
that was always the whole goal, though. I mean, that was always part of the prophecy, right? I mean,
But why couldn't he just destroy Sodom? I mean, one thing I could see, but I don't like this idea, is that so one thing they said, because he opened up the tears and did all the experimenting with the Lutesses, it accelerated his aging.
right.
So
Plus, there was a Voxaphone too that referred to him having tumors.
oh, so you
So
think
he.
he's too weak to do it?
Maybe, but like you said, I mean, it's not like Elizabeth was the one doing it. She just sent it all the, shooting all their turrets and cannons and flying boats and whatnot at him.
But clearly, I mean, they did it in 1980. The game is set in the 1900s. So they waited for that long. Like, she had to come into
That's true.
power and tell everybody. I'm still a little confused as to why she had to do it, why he couldn't bring it, aside from the age part of, well, hey, this guy might die. But I don't know why you had to have an heir do
I'm not sure. But anyway, we digressed again.
it.
So back on track. All right, so we're at the lighthouses. Take us through.
So, we understand everything has multiple universes, and so
So she takes you back to the original baptism choice, right?
yeah.
Where you split, and in Booker's life, he chose to reject the baptism, and in this is after what was the fight that they were in?
Wounded Knee.
After Wounded Knee, right? So Booker's all feeling terrible about this. Although it's funny because he felt bad, and then he got baptized, and then he went against all other races.
So this is a big point. This is a big problem I had. So well,
Well, sorry, let me finish this
yeah,
quick.
keep
So
going.
I'll set it up. So basically, in some of the timelines, it splits off, and Booker accepts the baptism, becomes religious, and starts basically trying to purge the entire world of any non-white people. And then the other one was
But I
he.
mean, it's not that quick, but yes, that's who we evolved into.
Eventually. So, and the other part of that is he rejects it, becomes Booker, and ends up having Anna, who we learn is Elizabeth. And becomes a drunk after he gives up Anna. He essentially,
This is getting so confusing.
I know, sorry, this is a terrible way of explaining it. And
No,
this is why I have Sean on
that's
the
what it
show.
is, though.
This is why I have Sean on the show, because he's much better explaining things than I am. But so you get into all this gambling debt, you have drinking problems, your wife dies giving childbirth, which kind of leads to all these issues. And then you give Anna away to the Lutesses, who are actually working for Comstock, in return for them wiping away your debt. And then you realize you made a mistake, and then they offer you... Well, they see where this is going in the future, because they probably see 1980 through a tear and Elizabeth destroying everything. And then they recruit you to go back and get your own daughter, which you don't realize at the time. But they don't tell you that either. They don't tell you that that's what happened, like that's your daughter. So they're kind of shiesty too.
Yeah, I think the reason why they don't tell you it's their daughter is, I don't know how it would have changed things. It clearly would have changed the way you go about it, because that's interesting though, because if you knew she was your daughter, I don't know.
Would that change anything? I don't really know.
Well, I mean, it would definitely change. I mean, because then
you would start again. You go there under the pretext that you think you're getting Elizabeth back to wipe away the debt. So you don't think that giving up Anna in the first place was the same thing.
Which is funny. So the wiping away the debt, so that means you start before Comstock steals Anna. Because if you're getting the girl to wipe away the debt, this is the whole part where the Lutesses open the tear because Comstock asked them to, and where the Lutesses are essentially getting you to get hand over your baby, and they'll forgive your debts, your gambling debts, and they will take the baby in, you know, Father Comstock will turn her into his heir. But so that's it. So at the beginning of the game...
Well, so we should mention that Comstock... The reason why Comstock did that is because he became sterile because of all the exposure to the tears. So he went and he saw that Booker had a daughter in one of the other universes and then went to take her since they share the same DNA.
And this, so they hint at this in one of the voxophones by Lutess. What's the woman's name? Robert and...
Oh, man.
I can't remember her name, but she... Rosalinda?
Rosalind.
So she, or Rosalind, she, there's a voxophone where she says that Lady Comstock assumes that she had an affair with Father Comstock, and that's where Anna came from.
Right, yeah.
And this is the whole thing. And she, and this is all spoken from Rosalind Lutess, where she says, you know, I would never do such a thing.
Right.
It's really a weird, how did she put it? It's like a... The way she put it, almost like a weird genetic mistake. But the point is, you can see there's some science aspect to the baby that you don't understand why, but it's different. It's not, right. There's something different and weird about it. And only later do you find out that it's, you know, your child from a different dimension.
I mean, and again, the way that they give you a little bit of information to push the storyline and keep you asking questions, but not enough to actually figure it all out before you get to the end is a brilliant, brilliant strategy. All right, so where were we?
Well, okay, I want to go a little bit back to Father Comstock when you get baptized, because this is a huge issue.
Right.
So, as you said before, you know, you're essentially at the end of the game where you get baptized. There's a point where essentially you have two decision trees. If you do not get baptized, you become Booker. Eventually, through giving up Anna and things like that, New York gets destroyed and all these bad things happen. The other option is you become baptized, and then you essentially you turn yourself into Father Comstock. You create Father Comstock. Mm-hmm. And then Columbia is born, and all these other things
happen. Well, so he meets Lutess during that time, and then she's the one who discovers the particle that, or the way to keep particles afloat, which ultimately is the technology behind running the city.
Sure. But my whole problem was, okay, Booker's a guy, yeah, he just came out of Wounded Knee. He wants to repent to some extent. How does he go, even in this ultimate or multiverse theory, how does he go from him to Father Comstock? Like, it doesn't fit his personality.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, he was through the Boxer Rebellion, and who is it, Slate that you meet, that you talk to during that time?
Yeah.
I mean, you clearly wiped out a lot of Asians, and you clearly killed a lot of Native Americans. They talk about some of the atrocities that they did during Wounded Knee. So, I mean, he obviously has these sentiments, and I mean, the America in general, and also you hear it through all the people you talk to in Colombia anyway. I mean, it really has this very anti-white sentiment that they all express, right? And it's all about purging and all of that. So, I mean, he clearly still has these feelings, and I think the way when he got baptized, he just felt that now he was cleaned of a higher power, and he wanted to take the whole religious route.
Yeah, I actually, well, so that's how I felt first is that I didn't understand it, but then my understanding was kind of exactly what you said, yeah, where he had those feelings. I mean, he just mutilated a lot of people. Like, it wasn't just I'm going to kill one or two guys. He destroyed a lot of people, and yeah, exactly. He washed himself, he absolved himself of his sins, but he still was that same person, and he still became this person. I mean, the religious angle still seems a little like how you become such a powerful figure. I mean, he's like the equivalent of Hitler in that Hitler could command Germans. Like, he had this gift of gab. So that still feels a little bit off, but it makes sense. Like, this idea that those underlying feelings, you're absolved of these sins, and then you become what you were. I don't know. What it becomes is kind of.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely something that you kind of have to come up with on your own or just
No,
be.
what I'm saying is I think that makes sense. This is one problem I had, seriously. I really didn't like this idea that he becomes Father Comstock because it just didn't fit for me. But I think what you were saying makes sense, the idea that, he really is that person. He just got absolved of his sins because he was baptized, which he really wasn't, and he didn't. He was baptized, but he wasn't really absolved of his sins per se. But it's interesting how far two paths can diverge.
Sure.
And
Yeah, and I think that's the takeaway of it, right? It really makes you introspectively look at yourself and the decisions you make in your life. At least it did for me. And it's just like, well, not just all major decisions, but smaller decisions too. I mean, if I do this but don't do this and make this choice, like, what are the possible
you could be
outcomes?
Hitler. Watch out.
Well, all right, Sean. Anyway, so.
Actually, and one side thing, because I don't think we're going to focus on this much because I want to stick to the ending, but one thing I really like when they were talking about the racism, there was something in the interviews, and they kind of pointed it out also in the game through the Vox votes. This idea that there's always, and they did the same thing in BioShock 1, where they had some of the splicers and where they got the little sisters from and things like that. Somebody's always got to be the janitor. So you
Yeah, that
create
was
this perfect world, but there's always going to be somebody who has
a
to do
lower
the work.
class, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that you can't, and I've always believed this, like I don't think you can have good without bad and things like that, but the way they did that was really, I mean, the way they had, it was black folks, Irish people, like, and it harkened back to where America came from, but I don't know, the idea that there's always got to be a janitor, which is something I really love, which I think is true.
Yeah, definitely. So, all right, so we're running close on
Back to
time.
the
So
end.
let's finish this up. So you choose to, well, basically Elizabeth explains to you that it doesn't matter. In order to eliminate this whole thing from happening, you have to die before you even make this decision. Therefore, severs any possible outcome of either choice, right? There's two schools of thought that I've read on the ending. So it shows all of the Elizabeths who've kind of transcended into this semi demigod state. They all come in, which is very similar to the ending of BioShock 1, where all of the little sisters are there for your death, which I thought was a cool comparison. So all of the different Elizabeths are there, and then they all drown you, and therefore cuts off all possibilities, and then each one disappears with all the piano notes, but then it cuts out on the last one when the last one is supposed to disappear.
By the way, beautiful scene. I mean,
Oh,
the
it's
piano
brilliant.
notes, it worked.
So my question to you is, the two schools of thought are that Elizabeth kind of, well, I guess there's three. So Elizabeth either transcended this whole loop and she escaped it and somehow exists, even though Booker doesn't. Either Booker dies before he makes his decision, before he has Anna, and therefore none of those possible outcomes happened, and the entire game essentially didn't
happen. How would that happen? How would he have... Because at the baptism, he's already had Anna.
No, I don't... No, that was before. No, that was before.
Right after Wounded Knee.
Right, and... so that was... He didn't have Anna till later. So this is before he had Anna. This is before anything in the game happened.
How do we know if he had Anna or not?
I'm more than a little certain that he didn't. It was afterwards. I don't know.
Okay, we'll keep going with that.
They kill all possible outcomes, but the other one I read was that they only kill the Bookers where he becomes Comstock, which I don't know a whole lot about quantum mechanics in theory, but I don't think that's possible, because if you have infinite possibilities of either, you can't kill infinite Bookers who make that choice to become baptized. So that's what they think is, though, Elizabeth, I guess the happier ending is that Elizabeth is still alive, because you only killed the Bookers that became Comstock.
Yeah, but
then you'd be left with a Booker who becomes a drunk and his wife dies and he's left with a baby anyway. So I don't know if that's really that much better.
I mean, it may not be better for Booker, but it's better for the world. So,
well, if Booker dies there, it's the same thing. Either way, the world doesn't have Columbia to come and destroy
it. So I'm saying it's still better. But so the third situation is that there are, you know, infinite number of universes, and this version, you kill Booker before he becomes Comstock, and it fixes this universe, I guess. Like, this one universe is good, or Columbia never exists, so on and so forth. But all the other possibilities still happen. And I'm torn on this, because at one end, I think that the last explanation makes sense, because there are infinite possibilities. How could you change one possibility and affect all of them? It's not really a hierarchical branch. You're really looking at it as all separate. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is, it feels a little useless. Like, you fix one world, it seems not that helpful. And the second thing is, I mean, I feel like they continually talk about this theme of getting at the root. Daisy Fitzroy talks about, how you have to cut out the root.
We haven't even talked about her.
I know. But we'll put her to the side for a second. Yeah. So you do that. Towards the end, when you're talking to Elizabeth, she always talks about getting to the source. And specifically to the source, as though you will affect all the branches.
Right.
But it still doesn't totally make sense to me. But, yeah.
So that's what I think, is that you kill Booker before he makes a decision, therefore cutting off all possible outcomes of either getting baptized or not.
Yeah, I think that's what they wanted to do. I don't think it completely works, but I think it's still something to discuss. And I think there's actually, it's another one of those pretty strong arguments for both sides. So,
yeah.
But that's what happens when you time travel and multiverse.
Yeah, this is just a random side note, but a little detail that you notice the second time around is that when Elizabeth is hitting you with the books in the beginning, the book that she's holding is the theory of quantum, about quantum theory that Lutèce wrote.
Oh, I didn't see that.
So if you saw that in the beginning, you're like, oh, this is what this is about. Like, I get it now.
That was like, I mean, there's attention to detail is incredible. I think one thing I noticed, or I didn't understand, when you're first in the boat, the two Lutèces are there, and then the male, or Robert Lutèce, or whoever, he goes, he doesn't row?
Doesn't row.
And I was like, no.
He doesn't row.
He can't row? I was like, no, he doesn't row. Like, this idea that that's just what happens.
No matter how many times you ask him, he's never going to make that the choice to row.
And there's so many other little things that I didn't
even discuss. The chalkboard where you flip the coin heads or tails, and then they keep track of what your choices or what the outcome are. So no matter what, that's one of the... Well, they go through the whole thing between constants and variables, and that's one of the big themes at the end.
So it's interesting. That actually point, just interesting side note, I found this on Wikipedia, so I guess it's not that. But that is kind of a reference to a play called, is it Rosenfield? Rosenfield and Guildenstern and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. And they're two characters in Hamlet. They're not main characters at all. and they decide to make a play of them two and from their perspective. And in the beginning of it, there's a part where they're flipping a coin and it always comes up tails. It's always come up heads. I don't remember. Actually, it's probably heads, because what's in the game? Is it heads?
Heads, yeah.
So it always comes up that. And they don't understand how is it possible that it can keep coming up like that. So it's a direct reference, I think, to that, because they do that exact same thing.
Yeah.
And then something changes.
But all right, so we should probably wrap this up. We're running out of time
here.
We could go on for hours. I mean, honestly, we've probably spent more time talking about it than playing it at this point.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something, if you only played it once, you should play it again and actually...
I need to play it again. So good.
Is there anything, any other closing comments you have?
Well, I think both of us just, at the end of the day, what did it mean to you? So for me, it's already on the list of some top 10 or 20, and I'm sure it'll continually move up in terms of narrative. And this, to me, is very important because... so. I kind of think this is video games' version of Watchmen. And not that the stories are similar at all, but the point of Watchmen, one of the reasons behind, the impetus behind making it was the author wanted to show that comic books could be a medium where you could tell true narrative. It wasn't just like, oh, kids just read this, Superman, Batman. He wanted to show that it had depth, it had real characters and all these things. And that's what Watchmen did. It's an incredibly powerful story. It's really relevant to the time. A lot of it works during the Cold War and things like that. And even today, like I read it, it's incredible. I feel like Infinite is kind of that game where you all of a sudden realize, hey, this really is a mature medium in other ways. And even the name, like I thought Infinite, I thought it was such a stupid name. Like that seems like some cheesy thing.
Right.
So until you play the game, you realize that makes perfect sense in terms of the game. And so I think it's a huge moment for gaming right now, in my opinion. I actually still like the gameplay. I didn't think it was that bad, but I know a lot of people didn't like it. But by no means perfect, but it's just something you think about and something that it's no other game has pulled me in like this, aside from, or no piece of entertainment has pulled me in like this, you know, other than TV and movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much just mirroring what you said. It's definitely a new bar for this medium as kind of emerging as an art form and as a way to tell stories and portray stories and have people be involved in the whole process of it and put you in the place of these characters and really make you feel genuine emotion for the characters that you meet in the game. That's pretty much it. Sean, you pretty much summed up everything I was going to say, so thank you for that. So join us again about 1 week's time where I don't know what we're going to talk about yet. Do you know? I think we'll talk about the, what is it, Facebook Home? I think we should talk about that next week because you've started playing around with it. I think that's definitely something that people want to know what the experience is like. Even though it's funny that you used it, but you're the only one out of our group that has Android and you don't have Facebook, so I don't know if you're the best to talk about.
Yeah, or I don't use Facebook. So, yeah, we want to talk about that a little bit, kind of how the paradigm of phones is changing, Facebook Home is pretty unique to Android and it could only work with Android, so we want to talk a little bit about that and maybe some other tech news that's going on.
So look forward to that. Look for that. We'll also be starting our site, The Commentist Block. So look for that. We'll post a link as soon as it's available. And other than that, just remember that even though he could help you out rowing, he doesn't row. So we will see you next week. Thank you so much.